feelings of others. We prefer to relate to sociable people. What do you do when someone in your intimate circle is not playing honestly? It helps if the people in your extended family have ways to talk about what is going on, to share experiences and feelings. If everyone is too ashamed to admit to having been misused by someone with an untrustworthy hidden agenda, then no one will have the information they need to protect themselves. There is no shame in having believed someone's lies, and most of us at some time or other have given our trust to someone who turned out not to be worthy of it. It is possible to fool an honest person, but we hope you have enough humility to learn from your mistakes and not get fooled twice. All these difficult scripts are about somebody not being honest, and are also about somebody having sex while avoiding intimacy and emotional connection. When you are not telling the truth, you cannot be present. And when you are not present, you can't be connected to anyone else. And when you are not connected, how can you feel anything at all? By treating lovers as people and letting relationships take the shapes they want instead of the forms forced on them by the culture around them, ethical sluts can form friendships that last as sex waxes and wanes. Chapter 10. Flirting and Cruising. Flirting and cruising are fine arts and skills that you can learn even though few people develop them overnight. Is there a difference between flirting and cruising? Some people think of flirting as what you do in environments that are not erotically oriented, and cruising as what you do in clubs, conferences, bars, and other places where people often seek sex partners. Or you might see flirting as a more introductory maneuver, and cruising is what you do when you know for sure that you're interested. Both involve an exchange of sexual energy in the form of eye contact, body language, smiles and warmth, and little flashes of erotic energy that can be shared long before any physical contact would be appropriate. Sex roles can complicate both flirting and cruising. Men in this culture are taught to push, to insist, never to take no for an answer. Women are taught to be coy, to refuse, never to offer an outright yes. The more polarized we get in this silly equation, the further we push one another away, with results that range from hurt feelings to date rape. The good news, though, is that both sets of behaviors can be unlearned, and that the more we unlearn them, the less there is to unlearn. When all genders feel free to answer yes or no, with no concern for anything but their own desires, a truer understanding and a more positive sexuality become possible. Dossie tells the story of a woman friend of hers back in the 1970s who decided to experiment with what was supposed to be every man's fantasy. She sat patiently in a singles bar one night, being approached by many men, until one to whom she felt attracted came along and began to flirt. He asked if he could buy her a drink, and she asked him, nicely, if he would like to come back to her place and fuck. He swallowed his ice. It took the poor fellow a couple of minutes before he could talk coherently again, and when they actually got to her place, he found himself impotent. They did share some perfectly lovely massage. That's how deeply ingrained some of these cultural stereotypes can be. Saying yes, saying no. If you're going to put yourself out there and make connection with fellow sluts, it is vital that you get good at saying two simple little one-syllable words, yes and no. For most of us, who have been taught that yes please is over-eager and no thanks is rude, these simple words may be unexpectedly difficult. Sexual sophisticates tend to give each other a lot of credit for knowing what they want. With this assumption, it becomes easier for your potential partners to make very direct proposals that might seem outrageous in any other context. That's because they trust you to say no if you're not interested. It is nobody's task but your own to figure out what you want, and nobody can or should second-guess you. So you are going to have to learn to say no, and to say no easily enough that having to turn down a couple of unwelcome come-ons won't ruin your evening. Men, as well as women, have trouble with no. Men are taught that they are always supposed to be eager for sex. So if someone comes on to a man when he is not ready or not interested, it can feel unmanly and wrong to say no. The trick to a comfortable no is to structure it in such a way that it's about you, not about them. So instead of, "With you? Are you out of your mind?" you're saying, "No thanks, you seem nice, but I'm not feeling much connection with you." Or, "No thanks, I'm not really looking for lovers right now." Or, "No thanks, I prefer to get to know people a lot better before I do anything like that with them." Important note, the thanks should be sincere. Being asked, even by someone you don't find attractive, is a compliment and deserves a thank you. If you think someone is ridiculous for finding you attractive, we worry about your self-esteem. Women have been taught that it is unfeminine to say no directly. Ask yourself, when was the last time you said no to sex? How did you do it? Was it with a polite and friendly but unmistakable no thanks? Or was it with a sort of, "Not tonight, I've got a headache," or "Maybe another time," or "I'll think about it," waffle? We strongly suggest you work out a no thanks that feels comfortable to you. Expecting the interested party to read your mind and somehow know that your maybe means no is neither ethical nor slutty. Women also need to practice saying yes. Our cultural myth is that the man in a heterosexual interaction pleads with or cons or bullies the woman into saying yes, or at least refraining from saying no, and then does whatever he thinks is appropriate. Women need to equalize here, to do more of the choosing, to know what it is that you enjoy, and to be able to say clearly what you want to whomever you find attractive. And if you are a man whose programming is more about what you think you are supposed to want than what you actually want, then you need to learn to say yes to your real desires when they appear on your doorstep. Once you've gotten comfortable with no, yes is usually easier and more fun. Try it in all its variations. Yes, please. Yes, when? Yes, but I have some limits I want to tell you about first. Yes, but I need you to talk to my partner first. Yes, but not tonight. How does next Tuesday look for you? Hell yes!
Exercise, practicing yes and no. Write down a little speech, maybe a few sentences, that you might use to invite someone to have sex with you. Write down another little speech you might use to decline sex in a polite and non-hurtful way.
The fine art of flirting. Everybody is born knowing how to flirt. And if you doubt it, watch the way a baby or toddler interacts with nearby adults. Lots of eye contact, smiles, maybe a chortle of welcome, and the offer of a beloved toy, which must, according to the rules, be promptly handed back after due admiration, just like adult toys. Most of us, though, lose this precious ability by the time we're grown-ups and need to learn it all again from scratch. Your authors believe that great flirting should be an end in itself rather than a means to an end. Practice flirting for fun, and maybe put aside for the moment any specific goals about getting laid. Focus on getting good connection. Watch the way many gay men flirt with straight women. Friendly flattery, lighthearted innuendo, non-threatening intimacy, all made possible by the realization that the interaction is intended simply for mutual pleasure, not in the hopes of a quick dash to the nearest bedroom. We suggest then that you learn to flirt simply by practicing. The sort of behavior you may associate with the word flirting, "Hey baby, what's your sign?" is not the sort of thing we're talking about here and is, in fact, its exact opposite. Great flirting is about seeing. Hunger to be seen is a natural human emotion, and when you show people that you're seeing them, it's natural for them to start seeing you. A lot of flirting is nonverbal. There's a way of holding eye contact for just a moment longer than usual. More than a passing glance, less than an outright stare. That lets a person know that you find them worth looking at. Turn your body so that you're facing the object of your interest and stay physically open, arms and legs uncrossed. Smile. If your flirting proceeds to words, we suggest a sincere, personal, but non-sexual compliment to start. Is the person at the dry cleaning counter wearing a new pair of glasses? Is the person next to you on the park bench leading a poodle that's sporting a fresh haircut? Did you hear through the grapevine that your next-door neighbor just got a nice promotion at work? A sincere compliment on any of these is a way of saying, I'm paying attention to you. You're not just a face in the crowd to me. This approach may not seem like flirting to you, but trust us, it's a great first step. Commenting on physical appearance, particularly in a sexual way, hey, those pants make your ass look great, is not what we're talking about here. Your goal is to make your friend feel fully seen, not reduced to an agglomeration of body parts. Watch for feedback. If we were cruising you and you turned your face away from us, took a step back, or crossed your arms, we'd know you weren't interested in connecting and we'd move on gracefully. We wouldn't like it any better than anyone else does, but we'd do our best not to feel rejected. You don't know us, and don't know what you're missing out on. Besides, for all we know, you're on the way to a date with someone you already know and are simply not available at that moment. One of the most successful flirts we know says he has a never-fail opening line. Hi, I'm Mike. From there, he and the object of his attention can proceed wherever their interests take them. The weather or scenery, their work, their kids or pets, the sorry state of the world today, their favorite foods, whatever. This stage of flirting is exploration, getting to know this wonderful new person, discovering the ways in which you're similar and the ways in which you're different, seeing how you might connect. The sexy part of this is in the energy, the flash of a smile, a brightness in the eye. You can usually tell when you're talking and when you're flirting. It's the energy. We recognize that if you are shy, or have been taught that nice girls or boys don't flirt, or are accustomed to a more predatory style of flirting, all this can be difficult to learn. We wish we had a magic flirting wand that we could wave at you, but since we don't, you're just going to have to practice. A willing friend, preferably of the gender, if not the orientation, that you normally flirt with, can be a help here. Pretend that you're meeting for the first time and try flirting. The friend can give you feedback about whether you're coming on too weak or too strong and help you refine your skills. When you start enjoying flirting in and of itself, without thinking about where it might lead, you'll know you're on the right track. Coming out slutty. Unless you're doing your cruising in exclusively poly environments, it is reasonable to expect that the object of your attentions may not, yet, have read this book and may not be familiar with slutty lifestyles. At some point, therefore, you are going to have to get it out there that monogamy is not on your personal menu of options. We can't tell you exactly when or how to do this, except that we vote for sooner rather than later. If both of you are just looking for a quick fling or a party scene, it may not be necessary to discuss such matters at all. However, if the fling leads to a second date, that may be the right time to let your new friend know that you're not interested in going steady, now or ever. Working this into a normal conversation about software or surfing can be a little tricky, we know. A quick reference to your partners, emphasis on the plural, often does the trick. Or you can start a discussion of relationships in general in order to get space to express your own opinions and desires. It may happen that the object of your attention is a devoted monogamist and that you nonetheless find this person extremely attractive. We have some words of advice for poly folk who fall in love with monogamists in Chapter 18, Couples. Cruising challenges. If you're standing in the corner of a room full of people, feeling like you're the only one there who isn't part of a happy group and like you're never going to be able to connect again for the rest of your life, we suggest finding someone else who's standing in a corner and starting a conversation. Janet's favorite opening line for these situations is, "Hi, I don't know a soul here. Can I stand here and talk to you for a while?" Beyond that simple opening, which gets easier with practice. Cruising strategies depend a lot on your own gender and the genders of the people you're seeking. 4. Men. Gay men have their own style of cruising, marked by a straightforward approach based on the understanding that most gay men are able to say no thank you without much discomfort. Without the uncomfortable threat of physical overpowerment that pervades man-on-woman cruising, and free of any requirements beyond following their own desires, gay men often are able to cruise each other with greater reliance on body language and nonverbal cues than their het brothers, confident, as we all should be, that if body language is not understood, they will use their words. Het men have different challenges. Few women like to be pushed, overwhelmed, or not listened to in the arenas of sex and intimacy. Most women are particularly offended by men who push too hard for private get-togethers or phone numbers, who insistently move the conversation back to sexual topics when the woman has tried several times to change the subject, or who touch them, particularly in a sexual, paternalistic, or covert way, without permission. Sneaky come-ons are a pain. It works better to simply ask, and if you hear a no, don't argue. Many a man has made the mistake of approaching a woman in the way he thinks he would like to be approached if he were a woman. If you're not sure if women find your approach too heavy-handed, imagine being approached by a large, strong man using your exact technique and ask yourself how that feels. Successful male cruisers remain sensitive to verbal and nonverbal cues, conveying friendly interest and appreciation for the fascinating human being in front of them. 4. Women. Most women are not very good at saying yes, and not very good at saying no. Your authors aren't, and we've been practicing both for a long time. We're not sure how things got to this state, where a woman is just supposed to stand there looking adorable, until some big strong hunk comes and makes her decision for her, but we don't like it much. Many women, both gay and straight, can benefit greatly from learning to be more assertive in asking for what they want, both during the meeting process and afterward. If you're used to sipping your drink and waiting for someone to make a move on you, initiating contact yourself may seem terribly awkward, pushy, yes, even slutty, at first. It's also scary as hell to risk rejection like that. It does get easier, particularly if you do get rejected a time or two and get a chance to find out that it isn't the end of the world. After all, we're not asking you to do anything that men haven't been doing for centuries, and you'll discover, as they have, the many joys of asking for what you want and getting it. For couples. Sometimes couples, or an established group of lovers, may be cruising for somebody or somebodies new to play with in a three-way or more. Cruising as a couple has its advantages. If you strike out, you still have someone to go home with. However, many cruisees are not used to the idea of openly non-monogamous relationships and may get a little freaked out when you come on to them with, "Hi, I find you very attractive, and so does my wife." Be reassured that you will also find many lovely people who actually prefer the safety and built-in boundaries of getting it on with one or both members of an established couple. And be prepared to find a goodly number of happy, shiny needles in your carefully chosen haystack. Some couples cruise together for someone to play with in a three-way, while others cruise individually for partners who want to play with one or the other of them. When you're coupled but cruising solo, please do remember to mention to your cruisee that you have a partner at home. Some people will be delighted to receive this news, and others will not. But full disclosure is the ethical part of ethical sluthood. If you plan to go home with your spouse when it comes time to leave this party, it is courteous to make sure your other beloveds know this in advance. Reassure new contacts by exchanging contact information and, if appropriate, choosing a place and time to get together in the future, like, "May I call you tomorrow morning?" Or, "Would you like to meet for coffee after work?" Whether you cruise individually or together, you need to work out your agreements beforehand. Who is interested in doing what to whom? Where? When? If one of you is looking for someone to hit the mattress with right there that night, and the other wants something permanent, she followed me home. Can I keep her, please? You may be headed for a major misunderstanding. Each member of a couple must have the requisite social skills. Depending on your partner to do all the work of introduction, conversation, flirtation, and negotiation is bad for you and bad for your partner. It may also lead to misunderstandings, since few partners are skilled enough communicators to get across all your needs, interests, and personality traits. A pet peeve of many sluts is the individual who treats one or more of the people involved in a disrespectful or objectifying manner. One example is the couple that sends an innocent-looking woman out as bait, and you may be startled when you bite to discover her spouse joining the party. Janet remembers once in a group sex environment being invited by a man to help stimulate his female partner. As she happily joined the group, she noticed that the man immediately shifted his focus from his girlfriend to her, ignoring the hapless girlfriend as he grabbed Janet's breasts. Needless to say, Janet excused herself immediately from this creepy feeling scene. It is disrespectful to treat the third party as some sort of oversized marital aid. Many bisexual women we know are driven to distraction by the hot bi babe phenomenon. Couples who seek them out, not because they're charming or hot, but because one member of the couple has a fantasy about playing with two women or seeing two women make love as a free peep show. The fundamental rule for cruising as a couple, or being cruised by a couple, is respect for the feelings and relationships of all concerned. You don't want to cruise someone who will try to steal you or your partner for his own, and your cruisee doesn't want to be used, deceived, or mistreated. We may refer to our play partners affectionately as tricks, but actually tricking them into your bed is unethical. When you treat everybody involved with respect, affection, and intimacy, you can reap very special rewards. Anything from a warm, happy fling to a long-term, multi-person relationship. For everyone, the best, most successful, and least obnoxious cruisers we know, of all orientations, are friendly, curious folks who like most people and are interested in talking to everyone. If some of the people they talk to turn into potential relationships, so much the better. When you find yourself worrying about how you are seen by others, remember that there is no point in pretending you are anyone except who you are. It does you no good to attract someone who thinks you are somebody else. All you get is someone who is excited about somebody who isn't you. When you are honest, you attract the people who are interested in you, just as you most wonderfully are. A good conversationalist is usually a successful cruiser, and more often than not, a skilled partner as well, because the give and take of good conversation and sensitivity to nonverbal cues are also important skills for the fulfilling relationships to come. Chapter 11, Keeping Sex Safe. The term safe sex, later amended to safer sex, was coined to talk about how we can design sex to minimize the risk of HIV transmission. But sex has never been altogether safe. Both your authors grew up in an era when an unwanted pregnancy meant a life-endangering illegal abortion. It's only been a few decades since more reliable birth control became available, and only a few before that since antibiotics began curing illness, insanity, and death caused by sexually transmitted diseases, STDs, like syphilis and gonorrhea. Herpes is still incurable, and we still have only limited answers to cervical cancer from human papilloma virus. No matter what your orientation, your practices, or your risk factors, in today's environment, careless sex can kill, which means that you have to protect yourself and your partners. Given that sex is never completely safe, ethical sluts put time, effort, and commitment into getting as much sex as they want at the least risk possible. Dedicated sluts have developed a plethora of risk reduction strategies that can minimize the chances of infection and or unwanted pregnancy. Please research the safer sex protocols that apply to your life and plan to protect yourself and your lover from HIV, herpes, hepatitis, gonorrhea, syphilis, chlamydia, shigella, human papillomavirus, cervical cancer, unwanted pregnancy, and a host of other nasties. We don't think you need to cover every portion of your anatomy with latex before you touch another human being. The goal for most of us is risk reduction, sort of like defensive driving on the freeway. Yes, a drunk could kill at any time while you were cruising down the highway, and most of us take our best shot at safety and go on driving. There are ways to have hot, satisfying sex without performing the erotic equivalent of skydiving with a faulty parachute. Here are some that we and sluts we know have used successfully. Barriers, the rubber fence. Utterly basic technique. Put something impenetrable between you and the virus. Today, many people decide to follow their sexual urges to far-out places by being scrupulous about the use of latex or polyurethane barriers. We hope you don't need us to explain this to you at this point in history, but careful use of barriers includes condoms for vaginal sex, anal sex, and fellatio, gloves for masturbation of a male or female partner, or for insertion of fingers or hands into vaginas or anuses, and dental dams or plastic wrap for cunnilingus or analingus. Gloves or condoms make it easy to keep any sex toy that will be used by more than one person nice and clean and bug-free. Clean your toys thoroughly after each use, sterilize if you can, and let them rest, clean and dry. Most of the bad bugs cannot live long without moisture. If there are toys that you really want to use on each of you within the same little bit of time, we suggest you buy two or more of them. The use of a good water-based lubricant can do wonders to make latexed sex more pleasurable for both or all partners. Along with smoothing out the friction of rubber on mucous membranes, a single drop of lube inside a condom increases the transmission of warmth from one person to another, which feels nice and, well, hot. For tips on how to use barriers in a pleasure-enhancing manner, check out Chapter 21, Sex and Pleasure. And if you're not completely comfortable using any of these barriers, practice. Gentlemen can masturbate with a condom or two or three until it comes easy. We have heard of one dedicated fellow who managed to put on 18 condoms at once. He said the tight squeeze felt really good. And why not get a little playful with your rubber? If you are inexperienced with condoms and plastic wrap, give yourself some space to learn. Get playful, spill some lube and roll around in it. Invent creative ways to wrap body parts in plastic wrap and then find out what interesting new things you can feel. Plastic wrap doubles nicely as a risk reduction barrier and a bondage toy. And it comes in colors. Explore the taste and feel of your safer sex equipment and check lubricants on tender places for allergic reactions. Not fun to discover when you are all excited, only now it itches inside you and you have to go wash that stuff out right now. Pay attention to the sensual qualities. Fine latex is wonderfully silky, and the best lubricants feel like liquid velvet. We want you to have fun and make wise choices. We need all the readers we can get, so we don't want to lose you.
Exercise. Practice makes perfect. For a man, commit to masturbating with a condom on at least once every 3 or 4 times you masturbate until you feel like you have that skill down perfectly. For anyone who has sex with men, buy a large box of condoms. The cheap kind are okay for this. And practice putting them on bananas, cucumbers, or dildos in as sexy a way as you can. First with your hand, then with your mouth. Use up the whole box. For everyone, make a list of ways you can get off with little or no risk of fluid transmission.
Fluid bonding. One popular safer sex strategy used by some couples is called fluid bonding or fluid monogamy. The couple agrees that they are safe to play with each other with no barriers and to use condoms and rubber gloves very conscientiously with all their other partners. Both of us have made such agreements with life partners. To do this kind of agreement, both or all partners get thoroughly tested for HIV and other diseases. You might have to wait 6 months to be sure, since HIV antibodies don't reliably show up in the bloodstream for some months after the individual is infected. Once you're both sure you're healthy, you're free to practice unprotected sex with one another and to use barriers with your other lovers. Be sure you're in a clear agreement about which sexual acts are safe enough to do without a barrier and which ones require a barrier. To reach such an agreement, everyone involved will have to do some homework on the risk levels of various activities and decide together what level of risk is acceptable to you. Don't forget to factor in information from everybody's individual sex histories. You may wish to restrict certain kinds of sex, often vaginal and/or anal intercourse, which place the participants at highest risk for disease transmission, to your primary relationship. Any time when you are actively trying to make a baby, you might not want to engage in potentially reproductive activities with all and sundry. If barriers were infallible, fluid bonding would be a nearly perfect strategy. Unfortunately, they are not. Some diseases live on the pubic mound, perineum, outer labia, or scrotum, which latex can't cover. Pinhole leaks can allow virus to creep through, although this happens less often than anti-sex crusaders would have you believe. Condoms can break or come off during sex. If you are fluid bonded and experience a condom failure, you and your partner will have to decide together whether to begin again with HIV testing and 6 months of barrier usage, or to risk the possibility that one of you has been infected and could affect the other. If there is any possibility of an unwanted pregnancy, talk together about the morning after pill. Avoiding high-risk behaviors. Another risk reduction strategy is simply to eliminate some forms of sexual expression from your repertoire. Many people have chosen to forego forms of sex that involve putting mouths or penises into or near assholes, feeling that the particularly high risks of this form of play are not worth its reward. Others have decided not to engage in any form of penetration with an organic penis. We have never heard of a dildo or a butt plug coming down with an infection. If all this winds up sounding like no sex at all, please consult a good book about sex. There are hundreds of ways to share really hot sex that don't involve somebody squirting inside somebody else. Every decision you make requires that you balance your own desires against your assessment of the risks. Remember when you're making your decisions that desire is powerful and important, and that there's no point in making rules you can't live with. One friend of ours points out that safer sex can be like dieting. I can be really good during the week, but then I binge on the weekends. On the positive side, expanding your range of hot sexual expression by learning new and exciting ways to have sex can leave you both safe and satisfied. Finger crossing. Simply hoping for the best, or denying that you're at risk, or pretending that diseases and unwanted pregnancy only happen to other people is not an acceptable strategy. If you don't have the honesty and courage to face the genuine risks of your sexual behaviors, you certainly don't have what it takes to be an ethical slut. And we question whether you should be having sex at all. We are shocked and worried by the levels of denial we see among some sexual communities who would like to believe that because new treatments have slowed down the progress of HIV, that the cure has been found. People are still dying. If your lifestyle seems to make you unlikely to get exposed to HIV, you are still at risk for herpes, hepatitis, HPV, and a host of other diseases. Kinsey's statistics from back in the 1940s indicated that slightly more than half of relationships that are theoretically monogamous in fact involve sexual contact with outside partners. Get educated, friend, and take care of yourself. Testing and prevention. We think it's essential for ethical sluts to get tested for HIV and other sexually transmitted diseases on a regular schedule. How frequently depends on the risk factors in your life. Ask your doctor, clinic, or Planned Parenthood office and follow their advice. While most STDs are preventable only with barriers and care, recently developed vaccinations can protect you against several potentially deadly forms of hepatitis and, if you aren't already infected, human papillomavirus. If you engage in non-monogamous anal or vaginal play, these are a very good idea. They are expensive, but cheaper than getting sick. You'll still need barriers against all the rest of the microscopic nasties. Birth control. Mother Nature is called that for a reason. Sometimes it seems like she wants everybody to be a parent. Even when you utterly know that you don't want to get pregnant this time, some deeper urge can easily lead you to forget a pill or count the days wrong. Birth control involves tricking the busy little eggs and sperm into not doing their jobs and tricking your own instincts into letting you do the trick right. Birth control technology is, alas, far from perfect. Reliable, reversible, easy, side-effect-free contraception is still a dream. Unwanted pregnancies need no longer be the life-shattering tragedies of yesteryear, but they are still awful, and we hope that none of you ever has to have one. If you are female, have intercourse with men, and could possibly be fertile, you must take active steps to ensure that you won't get pregnant until and unless you choose to. The possibilities include birth control pills, longer-term chemical birth control like Norplant and Depo-Provera, diaphragms and cervical caps, condoms, IUDs, sponges and foam, and tubal ligation, among others. Some women with regular menstrual cycles succeed at the rhythm method, particularly if they and their partners learn to enjoy outercourse during their fertile periods. There is a lot of good information available about the risks and reliability of all these methods. Your physician, clinic, or Planned Parenthood can help you make a good choice. For men who have intercourse with women, the choices are unfortunately quite limited. If you know you are unlikely to want to father children in the future, a vasectomy is a minor surgery that will relieve you of a great deal of worry. If you hope to be a father someday, use those condoms and lobby for research into better male contraception. The surgery to sterilize women is more involved. The surgeon will cauterize the fallopian tubes. This requires a hospital and a little recovery, but nothing dreadful. Remember, you'll still need protection from infectious diseases. When someone gets pregnant unintentionally, this can be, to put it mildly, difficult. If everyone involved agrees that an abortion is the best choice, that can be pretty unpleasant in and of itself. If there is disagreement, it can be shattering. Until such time as science enables men to carry fetuses in their bodies, we believe that the final decision has to be the woman's. But we sympathize deeply with the man who would like to raise a baby and whose female partner isn't willing or able to carry it. We do think that both partners should share in the financial and emotional burden of an abortion or a pregnancy. If one or both partners is interested in being a parent, and the woman is willing to carry the fetus to term, ethical sluthood opens up a wealth of options for parenting. Please don't feel that the only way to be a parent is to get married and buy a house in the suburbs. Perfectly marvelous children come out of shared parenting arrangements, intentional communities, group marriages, and a multitude of other ways to nurture and support a child. Committing to healthy sex. You may notice that we have gone out of our way not to tell you what decisions to make about your sexual behavior. Only you can decide what risks feel acceptable to you, and we believe that letting anybody else make that decision for you virtually guarantees that you won't follow through on your choices. You must, however, make choices. You must choose to do your homework and learn what you need to know about risks and rewards. You must choose to do the work of saying no to sex that doesn't meet your own safety criteria, and of being prepared to say yes to sex that does. Discovering you're out of condoms at the wrong moment is a recipe for disaster. You must choose to approach your sexual behaviors in a mature, realistic, and sober manner. Intoxication plays a major role in a shockingly high percentage of HIV infection and unwanted pregnancy. You must be prepared to share your sexual decision-making and history with any potential partners you encounter. If consent is at the core of ethical sluthood, and it is, your partners must be able to give informed consent to whatever risks are involved in having sex with you. You, of course, have the right to expect that same honesty from them. You won't like talking about this stuff, especially not with a new lover. It's depressing and scary, definitely not erotic, and sometimes horrendously embarrassing. Allow us to reassure you. The first time is the worst. Practice makes perfect, and after you've been over all these ugly and lethal possibilities a few times, you will become less sensitive and learn to deal with what you need to with ease and grace. Many people avoid the discussion on a first date by agreeing on the safest possible practices for this encounter, then negotiating more specifically later on. If you know you have a risk condition like active herpes, silence becomes less of an option. You need to invite your lovers to collaborate with you in avoiding infection, and they have a right to enough information to make their own choices. On a cheerier note, getting good at talking about sex has some very nice rewards once you get through blushing. Chatting about the fun stuff is a turn-on and the best way to get exactly what you want in the way of pleasure. Then you can learn what your partner gets excited about, which will make you the best of all possible lovers. We, and most of the people we know, make fairly conservative choices about what health risks we take in our sexuality. We know from experience that it is quite possible to have exciting, satisfying, fabulously slutty sex without lying awake nights worrying afterward. And isn't that the kind of sex we all want to have? Chapter 12. Child Rearing. If you're raising kids today, you have it a little bit easier than sluts of yesteryear. Images of families in books and television aren't quite as limited to Leave It to Beaver and Ozzie and Harriet as they were in our childhoods. Still, even though divorce and single parenting are now acceptable topics, our culture is slow to catch up to the other realities of our lives. Media images of multi-partner relationships, same-sex relationships, and other non-traditional constellations are still rare. Yet kids take to these relationships quite readily. Perhaps more so than to the traditional nuclear family, children have grown up in villages and tribes for most of human history. Janet remembers having some of her first desires for group living during vacations with her then-husband's expansive extended family. She noticed that her kids, surrounded by loving adults with plenty of time on their hands, were happier, more docile, and less fragmented than she'd ever seen them. During her kids' teen years, she lived in a group household and watched her sons adapt quite readily to the comings and goings of a disparate group of adults, one of whom was almost always free to answer a question, troubleshoot a computer program, experiment with a recipe, or play a game. The single-parent ethical slut can check out a number of creative options for maintaining a fulfilling sex life while being a responsible parent. When Dossie was sharing a house with two other single mothers, one of her lovers used to babysit all the kids so all three mothers had a chance to go out dancing together. A friend of ours used to babysit for her younger sister and the kids next door so that her parents could mess around with the next door neighbors. Dossie never actually lived as a single parent, whether or not she was partnered, during her daughter's childhood. There was always a troop of friendly people living in sprawling houses, city and country. We have never had problems creating consistency and security for our children in a sexually interconnected extended family. While you might assume that inclusive relationships might generate massive inconsistency, our experience is just the opposite. Our connections tend to form sprawling extended families that have plenty of energy to welcome all the children, and the children readily learn their way around the tribe. Some shifts in the population are inevitable, but in our experience, children take that kind of mobility for granted and perhaps develop a flexibility that might serve them well later in life. If we prepare them for a life where any change at all is seen as a disaster, how will they manage? Better, perhaps, to learn that loss may be difficult, but we do get through it, pick up the pieces, and go on with our lives. One way parents can offer consistency to children is to role model healthy adaptation to change. Another good form of consistency is to be honest with yourself and with your children. When you live your life in integrity, everyone can count on you to be exactly who you wonderfully are. The binary nature of monogamy-centrist thinking tends, we think, to cause problems. You're either the love of my life or you're out of here. Both of us have found that opening our lives to other kinds of connections also opens our children's lives. For example, a former lover of Janet's has not been sexually involved with her for quite a while, but has become a sort of surrogate uncle and best friend to one of her sons, and is still a loved member of her household. As she writes this, he is asleep on a futon on her living room floor. Still, many parents have a great deal of difficulty bridging the gap between responsible parenting and inclusive relationships. Questions about what and how much to tell your kids, how to prepare them for difficult questions in the outside world, and how to help them relate to the new people who arrive and depart in their lives can be challenging for any mom or dad. Sex education for kids. As you've surmised, we think an abundance of relationships can be highly beneficial to family life and that children gain in role models, attention, and support in the polyamorous extended family. Clearly, children should not be included in adult sexual behavior, and many adults who have been wounded by sexual abuse as children can testify to the damages. Education, however, is not abuse, and children need enough information to make sense out of what the adults are doing so they can grow up to their own healthy understanding of sexuality. All parents must make their own decisions about what kind of sexual information their children should have at any given age. For the health and well-being of the child, a balance must be struck between offering too much information, which might seem scary or overwhelming, and too little, which might leave the child with the message that naked bodies and sexual arousal are so dangerous and embarrassing that it's not allowed even to talk about them. We don't want to terrify the kids, and we don't want them to come into their own adult sexual lives with the belief that sex is dirty and shameful. Remember, sex education is an issue for all parents, whatever their lifestyle. We want our kids to have good information and freedom of choice, and they are often living in neighborhoods and going to schools where many parents believe that kids should be denied all information about sex, or else they might turn out to be sluts like us. To make matters more complicated, our culture currently is deeply divided about the entire subject of sex information in kids. Some people consider any form of sex education to be somehow dangerous. Some authorities feel that when children have precocious information about sex, it must mean that the child is being abused by an adult. We are, however, adamantly opposed to abstinence-only so-called sex education. How are we to teach our children to say no to an abusive adult if we are not frank about what it is that they should say no to? When we try to keep sex secret from our kids, they are aware that something is going on, but they don't know what. And if we leave them to get their sex information in the playground or on the street from equally ill-informed other kids, we consign them to the jungle. Our kids need and deserve adult support in learning about and negotiating sexuality as they do in all other aspects of life. What to share and not. You'll have to decide how much your kids should know about your sexual choices, such as multiple partners, same-sex partners, or alternative family structures. Our experience is that kids figure such things out quicker than you think they do, but that they may not figure them out exactly right. One word of warning. If you are living in a community that does not share your standards about sex education, your desire to educate needs to be balanced against the need for the child to learn what is and is not okay to share with the outside world. When you teach your kids, you will need to talk with them about how other people's standards operate and about what information should and should not be shared. There are still many places in this country where living a non-traditional sexual lifestyle is considered a justification for legally removing your children from your custody. Even when you are sure you are doing no harm, you still may need to protect your kids from Mrs. Grundy. We can't give you concrete guidelines on this, because only you can know the atmosphere in your particular community and the personalities of your own children. What should they see? We think it's a good idea to model physical and verbal affection for children. That's how they learn to be affectionate adults. But you'll have to make some decisions about the appropriate dividing line between physical affection and sexual demonstrativeness. Do your kids get to see you hugging your partners, kissing them, touching them? These are all decisions we can't make for you. You have to think them through yourself, taking into account such issues as their ages, their levels of sophistication, and their perceptions about your existing relationships, and abide by your own decisions. Nudity is a gray area. We certainly don't think kids are harmed by growing up in households where casual nudity is the norm. But children who have never been around nude adults may be upset if nudity is suddenly introduced into their living room. Kids can be very sensitive to issues like sexual display, and flashing is clearly a violation of boundaries. Certainly, if a child expresses discomfort with being around you or your friend's nudity, his or her desires should be respected. And we hope it goes without saying that no child should ever be required to be nude in front of others. Many children go through phases of extreme modesty as they struggle to cope with their changing bodies, and that, too, deserves scrupulous respect. What should they do? It is illegal and immoral to allow your kids to engage in any form of sexual behavior with any adult, or to allow your partners to be sexual or seductive with your kids. Many children go through one or more sexually explorative and/or flirtatious periods in their lives. This is natural and common. But it's important that you and your friends maintain especially good boundaries during such periods. Learning polite and friendly ways of acknowledging a child's changing needs without engaging sexually is a critical skill for ethical sluts who spend time around their own or their partner's kids. Isn't that cute? You're getting to be such a big girl now. The best way to teach your child good boundaries is to be clear about your own and to respect the child's right to grow up free from violation. Answering their questions. Kids' questions about sex and relationships can often be challenging. From the 5-year-olds, but how does the seed get to the egg? To the teenagers, so how come you get to fuck anyone you want, but I have to be home by midnight? Here's where the skills you've learned in other parts of this book can come in handy. You owe your kids honest, heartfelt responses to questions like these. This is not the time to come on all high-handed and parental. Particularly with older children and teenagers, it's fine to let them know if you are feeling ambivalent or embarrassed about something. They'll know anyway, believe us. If a situation makes you angry or sad, share that too. They may need some reassurance that your emotion isn't their fault, and some reinforcement that it's not their job to help you feel better. It's also fine to test their willingness to receive information. Before you start heaping data on their heads, you can try prefacing your communication with a question like, "Do you want to know about whatever the topic is?" Janet remembers a conversation with her older son when he was about 10. She'd just done a birds and bees rap, and had perhaps gotten a little carried away. At the end of her long speech, she asked him, "So, as long as we're on this topic, is there anything else you want to know?" He replied, fervently, "Mom, you've already told me much more than I wanted to know." Good boundaries are important here, too. While your kids are certainly entitled to express an opinion about the way you choose to run your life, they don't get to dictate it. The flip side of this is that you owe it to them to help prevent their lives from being unduly impacted by a lifestyle they never chose. Dossie willingly agreed to maintain a discreet closet about her lesbian partner when her daughter's junior high school friends came to visit. Her daughter got to come out to her friends about her mom at her own pace. Well, nobody ever said parenthood, especially slutty parenthood, was going to be easy. Your lover's kids. When your lovers have kids, you are involved with those kids, too. One friend of ours refers to the many kids he helped his lovers raise as his practice kids, helping him learn parenting skills for the child of his own that came along later. You'll need to make decisions together about what to tell the kids about your relationships, and you need to learn what decisions are conventional in your lovers' families. It may not matter whether younger children know or understand that some of the connections in their families are sexual and others are not, but all adults in families with children have a responsibility to make a connection with the kids we come in contact with and to foster our own children's connections with our friends and lovers. Single sluts with no previous connection to children may find themselves in a position of needing to learn how to deal with children in their extended family. Fact of life. Everyone around children will eventually need to set limits with them. There may be some challenges as you work to reconcile your own limits with the habits and styles of a family that was working just fine before you arrived in it. Expressing your needs can be an opportunity for the kids to learn that different adults have different needs. That Jane can nap through a rousing game of inside tag, whereas Jean needs an hour of quiet. It may be that you find yourself disliking one of your lover's kids. Perhaps something about this particular child pushes your buttons. They may remind you of your horrible older brother, or maybe even your young self. Often the things that annoy us most about someone else are the things we dislike about ourselves, or our histories. Or the child may be angry at you, or dislike you, for reasons entirely beyond your control. Perhaps you are replacing a beloved parent or other adult who has been lost to death or divorce. Whatever the reason for this problem, you are the adult here, and it is your responsibility to find a way to solve it. Resolution will undoubtedly take some time, a fair amount of energy, and a great deal of patience. But we believe it will be worth it, for you and your lover and the kids. Early in Janet's relationship with her spouse, E, there was a lot of friction between him and her young adult son, mostly over issues that will sound familiar to any step-parent: housekeeping, noise levels, courtesy. Then, she recalls, we were visiting my mother for a few days, and the two of them were escaping the domestic whirlwind out in the backyard. E expressed sympathy about a difficult personal situation my son was encountering. They had a beer together and really talked, from the heart, for the first time. And suddenly, E could see my son the way I see him, as a socially awkward young man, not always too aware of the physical realities around him, but with a huge heart and a lot to give. From that evening on, they've had no trouble working together on normal household stuff and have in fact become good friends. When you establish a positive relationship with the children in your environment, they will respond by developing a positive relationship with you. We know of ex-lovers who have maintained close friendships over many decades with children with whom they had no biological relationship. Thus are slut families built and maintained. Part 3. Navigating Challenges. Chapter 13. Roadmaps Through Jealousy. Let jealousy be your teacher. Jealousy can lead you to the very places where you most need healing. It can be your guide into your own dark side and show you the way to total self-realization. Jealousy can teach you how to live in peace with yourself and with the whole world, if you let it. Deborah Annapole from Love Without Limits. For many people, the biggest obstacle to free love is the emotion we call jealousy. Jealousy feels really rotten, and most of us will go to great lengths to avoid feeling it. However, your authors believe that most people take the destructive power of jealousy way too much for granted, that they give their jealousy far more power than it deserves. After many years of living free and dealing successfully with jealousy, we tend to forget that we live in a culture that considers it acceptable to divorce or even murder a sexually explorative partner who has committed the unthinkable crime of arousing jealousy in us. Let us point out here that monogamy is not a cure for jealousy. We have all had experiences of being ferociously jealous of work that keeps our partner away or distracted from us, or our lover's decision to cruise the internet instead of our bodies, or Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday night football. Jealousy is not exclusive to sluts. It's an emotion we all have to deal with. Many people believe that sexual territoriality is a natural part of individual and social evolution. If you believe that, it's easy to use jealousy as justification to go